Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is February 24th, 2011. Thank you for all of our hundreds of listeners. I know we've gotten between 200 and 300 downloads of each archive lately, so we do know people are interested in these topics. And we have so many options on Blog Talk Radio. To friend, click follow, get all the shows on an RSS feed, or even upload the widget to your own website so you can have others get in touch with what we're doing. You can share this on Twitter and Facebook and join us on the live chat to ask your questions and put in your comments. You can even favorite and download this archive to conveniently listen in your car, on your iPod, iTunes, or computer. We know that Vaccinations and Your Rights is in the news specifically this past week, and I'm so pleased that Alan Phillips, attorney at law at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who is one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys, is on with us every single Thursday at noon. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. And he supports the legislative initiatives that are aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. Alan has published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters and appears regularly at rallies, conferences on the radio and television. And he does so much more on many other boards dealing with freedom rights for your health. I also want to remind people that he does have an ebook that provides information for people in every different type of situation, whether they're just a parent concerned about their child or in the military, and if you're an immigrant. There's so many different applications for this information. We want people to understand and exercise their rights and to learn the limitations of the legal system. Once they become aware and learned, they can then take some action. And that's why we suggest you visit the advocacy portal at nvic.com, where people can work with others to make legislative changes to help expand our rights in the United States. And this leads right into what's happened in the news recently, and I will let Alan, I will let him introduce this issue just as a starting point, and then we'll get back to where we were last week.
Well, Debbie, thank you for that flattering introduction there, and there has been a lot going on in the alternative vaccine arena in the last several days. Excuse me. Just a real quick correction, it's nvic.org.
Oh, I apologize
O-R-G.
On that.
Oh, that's quite all right. And they have a link on their home site there to the advocacy portal. And then the advocacy portal is the place to keep up with vaccine legislation in your state, whatever your state may be, in each of the individual states. Well, one of the cases that's in the news is a Supreme Court ruling that just came out on Rusewitz. It was a vaccine injury matter, and it involved a question about whether the claimants, the vaccine-injured person and family, could take their case to state court after having been through the federal vaccine injury compensation program and having been rejected there. And this case just went up through all the different levels until it got to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the ruling came down basically in favor of the vaccine manufacturers. It's, in one sense, it's a very simple case in that the fundamental issue was just interpreting the language of a statute, the wording. It was very poorly worded, in my opinion, which led to two, if not multiple, interpretations of what Congress really intended. And it's sort of unfortunate that you can't just go back to Congress and say, could you tell us what you intended when you wrote this, that instead you have to go through a series of court cases over a period of years and let the courts decide what Congress intended. On that level, it almost seems kind of silly. There are a number of, I think, misunderstandings about what the case was about or what the implications are, and then several different factors that the court looked at. And it's a long opinion. The final published opinion is not out, but the preliminary opinion is 57 pages. So I started diving into that this morning, and we'll come back to that in a later show to go into more detail about not only what was the court's rationale, what was the case really about, what are the ramifications of the decision, but what are some of the underlying implications? Because, Debbie, there's some real deep and broad underlying issues here. Why do we even have the vaccine injury compensation program in the first place? Is that something that should continue? And especially in light of this ruling, is that something that needs to be overhauled or redesigned or fixed or what have you? So there's just a lot of different parts and pieces to that case, and we will definitely come back to that when we can spend more time. Today we're going to pick up where we left off last week.
We were talking about House Bill number 416, and that is in New Hampshire? Is that
correct? It is. And one of the activists there got in touch with me and said, Alan, could you write something for us? And in support of that, and they thought, even though I'm not a constituent, I'm in North Carolina, not New Hampshire, they thought that nonetheless having something from an attorney might carry a little more weight and help to clarify. So in putting something together for them, really what I did, Debbie, was put together a template. This is a document that anybody in any state could use if they'd like. They're certainly welcome to. In arguing for philosophical exemptions or any even broader issue concerned with vaccine rights and freedom of choice. And as I was putting this together, Debbie, it sort of occurred to me through this, there is something here that is more and stronger than simply a rationale for why we should have conscientious or philosophical exemptions for immunizations. As I was pulling this together, it just became clearer and clearer the further I got into this that we have, as a society, a moral and ethical imperative. It's not merely justifiable, but when you look at all the different pieces of this individually and collectively together, there's a moral and ethical imperative. And I didn't even get to the part about which really, in one sense, is one of, if not the most fundamental issues, and that is that there are parents who take their kids to get vaccinated and then subsequently watch their kids decline into any of a broad spectrum and wide variety of different sorts of chronic illnesses and diseases. And, you know, couple this document with the testimony of parents coming in saying, you know, we haven't had any serious infectious disease problem here in decades, but now we have this many children who whose parents see perfectly normal, healthy children until they get vaccinated, and then suddenly the children start declining. And regardless of what the quote-unquote authorities say about whether or not vaccines, for example, are connected with autism or some of these other disorders that fall out of that umbrella term, parents are watching this before their eyes, and many times there's just no other plausible explanation for why this happened. And so, and of course, there are independent research sources that support very much so a connection between vaccine and autism and other chronic illnesses and diseases.
Right.
So it's
and you know what? When you go to your doctor and you're a mother who lives with your child every single day of their life, I think it's an imperative that the doctor and the physician listen to the parent who knows that child the best. And that's one of the things when you look for a physician, that they do hear you when you're talking to them, and they take the time with you to really understand what you're all about and what your needs are, so that they can be met and you have a trust relationship. And that's very important between the dynamics between a patient and a physician. So I think that is really, really a good point, Alan. I want to let's refresh for the folks who are just coming in the first time on this bill. House Bill 416, it's adding an exemption from immunizations for conscientious beliefs. It appears there are many valid reasons why parents would decline or make a choice not to vaccinate, especially since all this news is coming out every single day. And if you go on YouTube, you're going to see the testimonies of parents who show what happens to their children either immediately or weeks or months following vaccinations. And in addition, I wanted to point out that these vaccinations can have a delayed effect on the immune system, so that now adults, either in their 20s, 30s, or above, can be declining more rapidly and getting these autoimmune type diseases and not really understanding how or why it comes about. Perhaps there are a lot of factors, including pollution and lifestyle and diet and those sort of things. But vaccinations is a component, and we need to take a close look at that. So let's take a look at what the 9 points, I think we've gotten up to, we covered up to point number 4, and we're up to number 5. So on point number 1, you were giving credit given to the vaccines for the 20th century childhood infectious disease declines is misplaced. So that is a statistical type of analysis where if you go in and look at the statistics, what is happening when a vaccine is given to a population, is there a decline in the disease population before, during, or after? And we're not going to go into that today. Then we have number 2 point that you had. A reliable vaccine disease risk-benefit assessment is not feasible. Can you restate what that answer is in just a line or two?
Sure, and just quick summary, that the bottom line is we do not have precise disease mortality data, and we do, and I have some examples of that in this report, and we also do not have reliable, precise information about the number of deaths and injuries caused by vaccines. And the only way, of course, that you could make a reasonable and reliable risk-benefit assessment as to what is worse, the vaccines or the disease, is if you had reliable, accurate figures, but we don't. And so it's really the current policy of vaccines without any without philosophical exemptions where that occurs, and that's in most states, about 30 states now here in the U.S., do not have a philosophical exemption. That the absence of a philosophical exemption is based on information that is profoundly imprecise and unreliable, to the extent that it's asserted that vaccines have a net benefit.
Right. So this is really talking to those people who say all of this medicine that we're doing is completely scientific, it's completely tested, we have the facts, and this is our answer. That's not really true. What you're putting before us is if you really take a closer look, they don't have it all together. It's not confirmed absolutely. There are questions about that risk assessment.
Let me mention real quick here, Debbie, slide in, that a copy of this document is posted on the vaccinerights.com website. If listeners would like to follow along or go look at a copy of this later and read through, it's there on the vaccinerights.com homepage.
Right.
There is a link to I'm pulling that up real quickly here so I can tell it to you directly off the page. There is a link there, and the homepage is a small page. There's a link there that says expand your rights through legislative initiatives, and follow the links there to legislative projects, and that's all the different things that I've done work with people in different states on different vaccine rights legal issues. But the New Hampshire one is there on the vaccine rights homeopathyworldcommunity.com site, or anyone
right.
is certainly welcome to email me directly, attorney@vaccinerights.com, if they have comments or questions or want me to email them a copy or email them the link.
Okay. That's a good place to go. He's got a ton of information on his website, and he has lots of resource links and other information. So we're up to point three.
Yes.
The belief that unvaccinated persons pose a risk of harm to others is without merit. And that is covering the issue of herd immunity. Is that correct? Or
that's
not.
That's the primary argument, that you have to have most people vaccinated or everybody's not protected. And, of course, for that to be true, it means that the herd immunity theory must be true, but there are many studies that have dispelled that myth. Herd immunity, at best, is just completely unreliable. But for an unvaccinated person to be a threat to others who are vaccinated, the unvaccinated person, first of all, has to somehow be a disease magnet that somehow creates or attracts disease in communities, even those where diseases have been absent for decades. And then it has to somehow make all the vaccines and everyone else who got the vaccines not work. And most of those vaccines, at least as the mainstream medical community defines it, most vaccines do work most of the time in most
mm-hmm.
people. And so it really doesn't pass the common sense level. But we go, of course, into detail there, as we did last week, about why that really doesn't make sense. And then
okay.
that brings us up to speed and up to date now with point number four.
I think we have one more to go. I also wanted to mention to listeners that we are going to have a expert in vaccinations and homeopathy, not only today but in the future. There will be other speakers who have written extensively on this issue, and I'm really excited to introduce them soon. So number four is mandatory vaccination denies citizens the rights to choose proven safer and more effective alternatives. And this is talking about homeoprophylaxis, which we will talk about today. And what about just plain vitamin D? Because there have, you know, get the sun and take vitamin D supplements and you're good to go, based on many of these studies. So we're up to now, conflicts of interest raise serious questions about vaccine policy. And take it away, Alan.
Well, there are different levels to this, and this gets into the more somewhat more controversial issues with regard, when you start talking about conflict of interest and corruption, that, you know, it gets harder and harder, I think, when you get in this domain for people to hear, although I think that these are really some of the more fundamental and critical aspects to the analysis. So if we as a society are ever going to have the ability to maximize our effectiveness at maximizing the health of our citizens and most effectively dealing with and treating disease or any sort of health problems, we have to have complete transparency. We have to have integrity and honesty. We have to have the ability for all ideas and all opinions to be on the table. And the true state of affairs of our current society, when you dig beneath the surface, is so contrary to this. We have really quite a mess in the world today to clean up, and this is probably one of the fundamental concepts or parts or pieces of that issue generally. But to be more specifically, the vaccine policy in the U.S. is really set primarily by the ACIP, that's the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. They develop written recommendations that end up being adopted by the CDC. The CDC turns around, of course, and recommends, makes their recommendations to the states. The individual states will then usually enact, if not literally, they will enact substantially what is recommended by the CDC. There are some differences state to state in terms of what immunizations are required or not, and, of course, quite some variation in what exemptions are offered sometimes from state to state. But on the whole, the policy overall really is driven by the ACIP and the CDC.
That's the line. That's the line of action from where it emanates. And then, well, where does the conflict of interest come in?
Well, and this is an area that admittedly I need to do a little more research on to get more precise information. So I'll be general about this, and we'll come back to that at a later date if we can. And I have more specific information on some of the other points in this larger category of conflicts of interest. But I will say that it's my understanding and information I've gotten from, among other sources, the National Vaccine Information Center in the past, that there are conflicts of interest with the ACIP members. Some of these folks are right out of the vaccine industry or have other ties to the vaccine industry. And it's sort of a catch-22. Now, you know, one of my jobs as an attorney is to play devil's advocate, and I do that a lot with issues that I'm dealing with, and this is one of them. So from their point of view, if somebody's going to be setting policy for immunization, you want the experts in immunizations to be the ones doing that. You know, when at first brush, that sort of makes sense. Well, where are the experts? Well, they're the folks who are in the industry or who are otherwise...
They're producing the vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, the folks who know the most about vaccines, one could argue, are the folks who are immersed in that industry. And
uh-huh.
so they are the experts. They're the ones doing the research. They're the ones who are making the products. The problem, of course, is the very people, by that reasoning, the very people who you would pick to be the ones setting policy are the ones then that necessarily are going to have ties to industry, many of them, and profit potentially by the very decisions, recommendations that they're making. So, you know, there's
It's like when the representatives in our Congress vote themselves up a raise. I mean, they're going to benefit. They voted for themselves. Yay. But and where are the checks and balances in government? You know, we are supposed to have something that's going to oversee what one group is doing so that, you know, just human nature doesn't take over. And in the same way, people don't realize how easily it is that they can literally be bribed to go in one direction instead of following their moral and ethical path. And it's easy. I think everyone is susceptible to this. And so we need to have some sort of governance and a balance on the other side if there are other ways of doing things. And
yeah,
I guess that's what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And so the question, you know, arises in this specific context, who are people who have expertise on the topic who do not also have any conflicts of interest or minimal conflicts of interest. But, you know, even that question is subject to being misapplied because to assume that only people steeped in the allopathic model are the ones that have any information of relevance to this issue because it's an allopathic procedure would just be a gross missing of the target here. I mean, the concerns and the interest are much broader. So it's driven. The short story here is that vaccine policy is driven by the vaccine industry, and we'll see a little bit more about how that is. Just as a quick side point, I had opportunity a few months ago to see the now former Speaker of the House here in North Carolina at the North Carolina's state level General Assembly, talking to a group of attorneys, and made the comment that something to the effect of that if everyone who had a conflict of interest, and he's talking again about the state here, not the national federal Congress, I think it would apply probably anywhere else, though, frankly. He says if all the people who had any kind of conflict of interest did not vote, then every time we had a vote on a bill, you'd have about, you know, 3% of the House and Senate voting. And it was a way to kind of just in one sweep to just sort of dismiss the question about conflicts of interest as though, well, that's something that you can't ever avoid as a practical matter, so we'll just sweep it off the plate here. And it seemed to me later when I was thinking about that, that's kind of like saying, okay, my house is on fire, but now the fire has gotten too big for me to put out with the garden hose, so I'll just go on back in and watch TV. You know, it's
I don't know. I don't get that.
Well, no, to say that we can't deal with conflict of interest because it affects almost everyone.
Yeah.
Is like saying the fire's too big to put out, so let it burn.
My typical aphorism is two wrongs don't make a right, you know, but you're pretty good at it. Okay, so, right, just because we're not capable of handling it in one place doesn't mean that we can't take care of it in another place. And
well, not even that. What it means is that conflict of interest is no less an issue just because you don't see a simple solution to how to deal with it.
Right.
We have to look at the issue more closely. If what we end up ultimately needing to do is completely redesigning the system, then let's completely redesign the system. It's not acceptable to have outcomes driven by the people who are going to, as you say, you know, vote themselves a raise or. That in and of itself may be okay as long as it's the same thing that every other government employee is getting or whatever. But, you know, to vote themselves out of the new health care bill, which Congress has done, you know, they're exempt from certain things. Just read something today that certain people related to, I don't know, it was congressional aides or whatever, but people who were had connections with Congress, now their kids don't have to pay back their school loans. And what?
Oh, really?
Something
hey.
About that. Now, I just read that briefly and quickly. I don't have the full story. But my point is this, and that you already made earlier, Debbie, is that when these people have the ability, when people who have conflicts of interest are given the opportunity to make important decisions, we can expect that their decision-making is going to be skewed.
Right.
And that's why we have judges.
That's what a judge is supposed to be, unbiased in their decision making.
Judges have to recuse themselves, which means take themselves off the case if there's even the appearance of a conflict. But legislators don't.
Right.
They don't necessarily have to pull themselves out of the vote. Sometimes I think some will if they have a really strong conflict of interest. But we have exactly the opposite in federal law when it comes to vaccines. We have laws that say they can grant waivers of conflict of interest so they can go ahead and vote anyway.
Oh, what is that?
We actually have laws that say if there's a conflict of interest, you can waive that conflict of interest so they can vote anyway. And again, I think the theory is, well, these are the experts, so they're the ones who need to handle the decisions. But let me move on here so we can push on through. The bottom line is that there are some conflicts of interest at the fundamental level where vaccine policy starts in the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. We have conflicts of interest at various other levels as well. And this example that I have been repeating in recent months about the CDC, the director of the CDC in 2009, Dr. Julie Gerberding, announced that she was changing her job from CDC director, where, of course, she promotes vaccines, to president of Merck Vaccines.
Right.
We have this so-called revolving door between agency and industry, whereas an objective way of setting this up would require either that you couldn't go between agency and industry, or that there would have to be some lapse in time so that you could not go directly. You know, should be at least 5 years, you know, after you leave a federal agency before you can go work for the industry, or some period of time. People who are making decisions in agencies, if they know they have the possibility of getting a high-paying job in the industry when they leave the agency, are they going to be objective in their policy setting or recommendations? Again, it's a situation where it would be impossible for anyone in that position to be fully objective. And we could expect that some portion of the decisions would be skewed accordingly.
It seems like the people who really take a second look at the alternatives are those people who have personally been injured in some way in their family. And then they begin to have doubt and question. And I think this is happening more and more, and that's why we have such a schism in our society with the anti-vaccination folks and the people who say, we're going to be protected, and this is good for us, and this is good for herd immunity, this is good for our society and our population overall. But, you know, it has changed. So the vaccination scheduling has changed so drastically, and what goes into the vaccinations have changed over the decades to be I wouldn't call them the same thing as what they were.
I saw a real interesting graph recently, Debbie, showing the correlation between number of vaccines required in the first 5 years of life, and that varies from country to country, and the mortality rate of children under five as well. And there is a direct correlation between the number of immunizations required and the mortality rate. That is, the more vaccines that are required, the higher the mortality rate for children under five. And the U.S. has the most vaccines required of the countries that were included in this sampling and for this particular graph out of about, I don't know, it's about a dozen or so countries. And
if you find that, we would love to have the link for that.
I do have the link for that, actually. That's on
okay.
the Pandemic
okay.
Response Project.com website. And PandemicResponseProject.com, there's a link at the top that says Resources, and on the resource page is a link called Vaccine Graphs. Let me make sure I've got the right one here, but I believe it is. Yes.
Okay.
It's one of the graphs on that list. That's a long list of graphs, among other things, that show that the vast majority of disease decline preceded vaccines. So when people, you know, you see this over again, and I saw this in the Rusewitz case. I've read the majority opinion. I haven't had time to read the dissent opinion yet. But I see this throughout the majority opinion where they make these sweeping references to, you know, how wonderful and great vaccines are. And it's really disturbing to see the U.S. Supreme Court attribute disease decline to vaccines when there is all this credible information coming right out of official sources.
Are they using different graphs? Are they using different numbers? How are they making the correlation? How do they make that statement?
They are using, obviously, other sources than the one I'm referring your listeners to, our listeners to. But and in the majority opinion, they make references to the quote-unquote authorities, you know, Federal Health and Human Services and so forth. I mean, they do all the things that we ought to be able to do and which they, as the U.S. Supreme Court, probably necessarily have to do, referring to official sources. The problem is that the official sources are not objective. They're skewed, they're biased,
yeah.
They're influenced, and so forth. So people will see this, you know, in the court opinion and criticize the court, and I'm not nearly so – I'm disappointed in seeing what I believe is false information reasserted yet again at such a high level of authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be sure, I find that, you know, troubling, if not deeply disturbing. But I don't so much fault the court as I do the agencies and systems they're referring to, because they ought to be ones that we can trust and that are objective, but they're not. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's you know, it's complex problems here.
Right. So
but anyway,
if you're being fed misinformation, or I call it a half-truth, if a half-truth is a lie. Because if you're only given half of the information, then you're not getting the complete picture. And that's what's happening, that the other components like vitamin D and the huge Cuban homeoprophylaxis event, these things are not being disseminated as part of the total package of information in order to make a final decision.
Yeah,
and,
welcome to the world of how to use statistics to achieve any end you want. You just use the part
right.
that works for your goal.
So now we have these conflicts of interest that exist at the international level. And on June 3rd, 2010, the British medical journal, BMJ, revealed the existence of undisclosed serious conflicts of interest in the World Health Organization, along with scientifically unsupportable distortions of information from the WHO concerning the swine flu pandemic. So we definitely, I mean, this is right at the tips of our fingers. This is the here and now. This is just a short time span, 1 year, of looking at the swine flu pandemic as a microcosm of this, these decades of what's happened to vaccinations. You want
and
to
here,
talk about that?
Sure. And herein lies, I mean, first of all, this source for this, as you noted, is the British Medical Journal. This is a mainstream source. This is not some, you know, alternative that you can just write off because it is an alternative. And it's not a conspiracy theory, or if it is, this time the conspiracy theorists were right, as validated by not just the BMJ, but other credible mainstream sources. And really, I want to tie this all back into the larger document here, which was drafted to support passage of a state-level conscientious exemption immunizations. What this means is, all of this means is that states need to go to, they need to not be just automatically deferring to these so-called higher authorities, the ACIP, the CDC, the WHO, but rather states need to be saying, well, okay, that's what you guys say, but you guys are in a position where there's a significant risk of skewed recommendations. So we need to be, we the states need to be evaluating and reevaluating, making our own investigations to see if we come up with the same thing. There are a lot of states that defer even in their laws to the CDC rather than duplicate their efforts and spend the money doing that, I suppose, is part of it. But generally speaking, federal authorities and federal laws considered to be a higher level of authority than state law. So there's a lot of deferring to the CDC and to federal agencies and federal authority. My contention here is that there's substantial evidence, substantial facts that scream ethically and morally that we can no longer afford to do that. We can't do that. States are certainly welcome, as far as I'm concerned, to consider the federal authority opinions and recommendations, but we cannot rely on those anymore, just defer to them. We have to
open it up.
Separately.
Yeah, we have to open it up. And you know, if you were, I mean, you're the lawyer. I don't know anything about it. But if you're doing a court case, you have to hear both sides of the issue, right? I mean, you go out to the best of your ability to go ahead and get eyewitnesses, to get testimony, to get all sorts of parts, pieces, and parts of the puzzle in order to really have a complete understanding of what that is going on for that event.
But in the legislative arena, you know, legislatures will often want to hear experts tell their opinions and sometimes opposing opinions too. So there are legislative hearings where that kind of idea gets addressed. You look at different views and opinions and so forth. But presumably, from a state's point of view, presumably the FDA has already done that when they license the vaccine. The CDC has already done that when they say, here's the policy we set, we recommend. And so really what I'm saying that states need to do is something that states are not going to want to hear because it's going to be inconvenient and impose some cost to states to do this. And what I'm saying is, yes, you do need to duplicate those efforts because the word coming down from them, it's not necessarily – it's not, you can't rely on it to be objective. I'm not saying it's always skewed, but certainly there is significant potential for it being skewed, and we cannot just defer to it, just rely on it. In effect – taken to the extreme, I would say that the CDC ought not to even do that anymore, that the states need to take that on individually and independently. Or we need to create some kind of entity that is truly objective. But I'm, you know, whatever you give somebody, the more power you give somebody, the more power you put in a position, the more people who are going to be controlled or influenced by your decisions, your position of power or a position of power, the more that those who want to control and manipulate that position and that power to their personal agenda, the more it will attract those kinds of people and the people who want to be there. So would it be duplicating efforts to have all states individually do their own assessment? Darn right it would. It would be much more costly than just having one federal agency do that and everybody just defer to that federal agency. And I'm not saying that all states completely defer to the CDC, but it's my impression that many of them largely do.
It's a fascinating concept, Alan, because you're talking about human nature again, and the fact, the issue of power, the issue of greed, these are characteristics and qualities in every person who, whether they know it or not, they have to keep it in check, and they have to recognize it and know if their heart is in the right place and if their intention is really for the health of the people or for the dollar sign or for fame or some other reason. I mean, these are big philosophical questions. And
but what can be summarized, for our purposes here, it can be summarized rather concisely, I think, though, and the bottom line is that human nature compels us to decentralize power to the fullest extent feasible. You know, if you need to have a common defense to defend against foreign countries, you might have to have a national military. I mean, I don't want to have that debate right now, but my point is there's an argument there. But we do not need to have a national health policy. That is something that individual states, or perhaps even more locally on some issues or some situations, can decide and probably should decide, because different states will come up with different solutions. And it's from those different solutions that we as a collectively have an opportunity to see how different solutions work or don't work in different places. So
it's a really great idea. And then it gives the people the ability, if they don't like what's in their state, to move to another state. And then if we see at the top, if we see that, oh, my gosh, everybody's moving to California or some other or Arizona or some other place because it's drawing them because of those particular values and issues that they can receive there, that will influence what they do in the rest of the states, would it not?
Well, yes, but and which leads me to my next point then, is that not only is there the opportunity for people to, or theoretically there's the opportunity for people to move if they like the way something's going better somewhere else, that's not always feasible for people, but perhaps more importantly, there's the opportunity for people to say, hey, we like what's going on there, let's do that here too. Let's change what we're doing so that we're doing what California does if we like what California does. But we're not going to have a chance to test different things when we create the one size fits all. Right. And that's true both in terms of what individual states are doing in terms of their policy and laws, but also in terms of what individual people are doing. If we don't allow people the right to say no, we're not going to have a chance to say, well, let's look at the now significant numbers of people who choose homeoprophylaxis or some other approach to dealing or no approach to dealing with disease. Let's see what happens to them compared to the ones who vaccinate. I mean, we have some compelling contrast, for example, that the Amish have either no or virtually no autism and they don't vaccinate, and they're, you know, that correlation is not proof of causation in a formal scientific sense, but in a profound common sense way, it screams out for there to be studies that compare significant populations of unvaccinated people to populations of vaccinated people and see whether or not or to what degree vaccines are the reason that the vaccinated population has autism and the unvaccinated population doesn't. But
There are many reasons then for making it more equitable that there are more options for people to choose, and instead of that just everybody blanketly has to do this one thing, especially when it has so many implications. And the problem is it's so controversial and not everyone is happy with it. Let's move on to number six of your points. That is for the New Hampshire Bill 416 that we've been speaking about. For any of those folks who have come in late, we're up to point number six. Reliance on the pharmaceutical industry is severely misplaced. I think we started to cover that one already, but you have it as a main title.
Well, and the bottom line is, however you slice it up, is that the pharmaceutical industry is what drives vaccination policy in the U.S. and increasingly, you know, throughout the world. And that in and of itself And even if you're going to, object to me framing it that way, let's put it like this: the industry even if they have nothing to do with setting policy, and I believe they have everything to do with it, but even if they have nothing to do with it, they are nonetheless the industry providing the product that we're talking about here, vaccines. And so it's fair to ask, especially as we discuss the points we'll get into under this particular heading, it's fair to ask, is this an industry on the whole that is one that is worthy of us putting such broad, widespread mandates? I mean, we have, you know, children are mandated to be vaccinated, at this point, right on up through most of their childhood, and increasingly
right, they have
so.
They have to go, before going to college, they also have to get vaccinated. So it's going into their young adulthood.
It is, and of course there's an agenda to have adults be required to be revaccinated as well.
Right. Booster.
I mean, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, as far as I can tell, does not have an end point to their agenda for increasing the purchase and use. They probably don't even care if they're used. They just want them purchased. Vaccines. Now that's, you know, that's for the money argument.
Well,
we get into the darker arguments,
having
them be used as well comes up. But
the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of manufacturing these vaccinations, and that's their research and development, and all of their money, is besides profits, is going into designing more and more vaccinations for every conceptual epidemic, including obesity, diabetes, any kind of autoimmune disease. I mean, you're talking about having a vaccine for literally everything. And, you know, it just really doesn't have any wisdom behind it in my thinking. It doesn't. It's not what I consider preventative medicine. Preventative medicine means let's strengthen the body. Let's do what's right for each of us to be healthier. And not suppress the immune system. And that's kind of going into another talk. But let's take a quick look over here. Let's see how much time we have today in this part of the show. We have about 10 minutes left before Manfred Mueller is going to be coming on and talking to us about specifically, because he's an expert in homeopathy, in prophylaxis and vaccinations today. So we're going to finish up this number six. The pharmaceutical industry regularly engages in what you're calling criminal behavior. I think it is too, if you're lying to the people. And in 2008, Merck was fined $650 million under the False Claims Act. In 2009, Pfizer was assessed a $1 billion with a B criminal fine, along with a $1.3 billion civil fine in its fourth settlement since 2002 over illegal marketing. This is just so boggles the mind. It's so questionable that they can go ahead, do these criminal behaviors, get a slap on the hand, which is in the billions of dollars, and then continue on and do it again.
I just want to underscore that when I say the pharmaceutical industry regularly engages in criminal behavior, that's not a sensationalistic claim that I'm trying to say that, you know, to me this sounds criminal. I'm talking about they are actually, in some cases, pleading guilty to crimes, criminal violations. They are being assessed criminal fines, and that
right.
almost always is, if not always, is part of a total fine that's both criminal and civil fines. So
right.
when I say they regularly engage in criminal behavior, that is a neutral, factual reality. It's not a sensationalistic claim there. And it's not limited
right.
to just one or two or three or four companies. There's a whole list here we don't need to go through. But there's a whole
okay.
list of companies in the last, let's say, 10 years that have had fines in the millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, if you add them up, if you add all of them up, it does turn into billions.
Well, over the last 20 years, they have averaged about $1 billion a year, but three-fourths of that has been in the last 5 years. So they're, you know,
uh-huh.
averaging more like $3 billion a year in the last 5 years. It's gotten considerably worse. And the sort of bottom line is here, when you think of it in those terms, and that $1 billion criminal fine for Pfizer, because one of the reasons it was that high was because it was the fourth time since 2002 that they had been caught, basically, and penalized for doing the same activity. So these companies are doing this over and over again. The only reason that I can think of for them to do this, not trying to get into the psychology of somebody who would do it at all in the first place, because that's something I can't wrap my mind around. Why would they even do it at all? But why would they keep doing it? Well, they must do it and keep doing it because ultimately it's profitable to do it.
Right. You don't keep doing something. Well, I mean, you could be in the habit. I mean, people know it's not good for them to smoke cigarettes. They're aware of that, and still they do it. What there's a reason, and maybe there's an emotion. Even though your statement about corruption and criminality is not sensational, maybe, you know, emotionally they have some sort of ties with what, you know, they can't stop themselves from doing it.
Well,
for some
if that
reason.
Were the case, no, if that were the case, they'd be putting themselves out of business, and they're not putting themselves out of business. So it has to be profitable. It can't be something that's emotion driven. This has got to be something emotional in a dysfunctional sense of it. It's got to be
right.
It's
they're hooked. They're hooked on their money. They're hooked on their big mansions and whatever else it pays for them to do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, it may be emotional in that sense, but it's a very. It's not emotional in the sense that it's not calculated. It is absolutely very deliberately calculated. There were a couple of cases where the courts said, your damages at this level, some higher level of hundreds of millions of dollars, but we're going to only fine you this much because, you know, in our determination, the court's determination, this is what the company can afford to pay. So the courts are actually lowering fines in some cases in order to allow the company to stay in business. And if somebody is engaged, if you and I are engaging in criminal behavior, we go to jail, you know.
This is the thing.
I don't know of anybody, any, you know, executives in these companies who are getting criminal fines. And criminal, you just have to understand, criminal is a very high bar. You don't call a fine a criminal fine unless the person doing it knew exactly what they were doing.
Right. You said that they did say that they were guilty.
In some cases, yes, they pled guilty to crimes. But, you know, when you're talking about fines here, some of these, you know, a lot of these are settlements, basically. You know, all right, we will, if you'll pay this amount, you know, criminal and civil fines, I guess, you know, nobody goes to jail or whatever. I don't know. But I don't know the deep inner workings. But, you know, you and I commit a crime, you know, we don't negotiate a fee based on what we can afford to pay in order to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go to jail.
Right. And they're not paying the full price.
And
in other words, they're not.
People are suffering from these actions, and they're just getting a fine. It's what it suggests to me, and this goes to the allopathic model as a whole, as well as to vaccines specifically, is that we as a society, at least in regard to these kinds of decisions, have decided that despite all the problems, this is still necessary. You know, in my point of view, and we'll get into this more at a future time, but in my point of view, if the vaccine industry is going to go out of business because their products are causing too much harm, they're going to go out of business. You know, let them go out of business.
Well, we did bail out the car manufacturers, didn't we?
Well,
we have
the vaccine industry didn't get a bailout. They got a free pass forever.
Right.
You know, it's much worse. But the reason they get that is because we as a society believe that their presence is necessary no matter how much harm their products cause. We can debate that point further later. But the bottom line is that the pharmaceutical industry regularly engages in criminal behavior. And my point about that is no one should ever be required absolutely to take a product from an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior. You know, that you could argue that no, there shouldn't be a vaccine mandate at all because of that, and that's not what we're trying to argue at this point. We're trying to argue that we are morally and ethically compelled to offer a conscientious or philosophical exemption,
right.
given the character of the industry that drives this whole thing and that produces the products.
Alan, I wanted to let you know we've got about 15 people in our chat today. We've got a lot of listeners. We have one, Dr. Bob always has something good to say. He's telling us that at his university, all the female students are being harassed to get the HPV vaccination, which costs them $175. And so that's a whole, that I think we could do a whole show on that unto itself. We have a little bit more time left. So we are, have we finished the issue here on number six? The reliance on the pharmaceutical industry is misplaced. Or
and you know,
have one
I think,
more thing.
I think we have, for our purposes of the show, and I would encourage folks to go pull down the document, you know, off the internet and read it. And these next couple of points can actually be addressed quite briefly to move us on to the last point, which we may have to save for another show. But shall I do that?
You mean your last paragraph?
No, the last
okay.
Points, number 7 and 8, are real quick ones.
Oh,
from
only,
my perspective.
One little point that maybe they didn't hear was that we cannot really know how many crimes were actually committed that were not caught and prosecuted. You know, we're looking at the statistics that you have, the numbers and the criminal fines and all of that, for what was actually caught on the books, caught
red-handed. Well, you know, that's a really good point, and I don't know, I don't have any information to suggest what the scope of that might be, because we're asking to count something that hasn't been counted yet. But it's a really good point, and we can say, it's very safe to say that with crime in a broader use of the word, not these specific crimes or kinds of crimes, but that criminal prosecution is something that occurs as a percentage of the actual number of crimes committed. That is, you know, the drunk driver may drive drunk 100 times before he gets caught swerving by a cop and gets a ticket or loses his license or whatever. There are people who commit murder and never get caught. I mean, we have all kinds of crimes that get committed, and we as a society do our best to track them down and hold the perpetrators responsible, but it is far, far, far from being a perfect system. And we know, we can point to these specific criminal and civil fines with the pharmaceutical industry, but we have no idea how many times they've engaged in criminal behavior that they didn't get caught.
Right.
If it is profitable for them to do this, and it must be because they're still in business and they're doing more of it, it's getting caught more, that at least suggests that there are times that they are doing criminal behavior that they're not getting caught. You know, how else could it be profitable?
That's kind of what I was saying before about having a habit that you can't break. I mean, if you are overeating, if you're eating something, but you're really not feeling the negative effects of it, you're not going to stop. But when you get diagnosed with something that is so severe that you must stop, that's when you do. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
there's a lot.
I think it's a more calculated thing. They know exactly what they're doing. They know they're going to get away with it most of the time, or enough to make it worth paying the fines when they do get caught. And they're looking at their bottom line, what's going to maximize profit. And if they have other agendas, and that's another topic for future as well, if they have other underlying agendas that need to be addressed by you know, violating laws, then they have other agendas. But the bottom line is, if it's not profitable to do it, they're not nearly as likely to do it. But I think the real deterrent that needs to come in, which has not been here as far as I know, is that the people in the decision-making positions in these companies who are making those decisions knowingly need to serve time. You start throwing these people in jail, I bet you the industry gets cleaned up significantly real fast.
That is the whole point. That is the bottom line, that they have to pay a personal price for their personal actions rather than just the company taking the brunt of it, because they're really not taking a loss. They're not taking they have to take a closer look inside of themselves. And I think that they don't have to do that if somebody's going to cover for them. That's maybe one way of looking at it.
Yep. Debbie, next week Greg Glazer's coming back, right?
Woo, yeah.
I wanted to get that out real quick because I see we're running out of time here.
Listeners. Maybe we should tell the folks who Greg Glazer is. Do you want to do that?
attorney in California, specializes, among other things, in constitutional law. Greg has written a memorandum talking about the constitutionality of forced vaccination in martial law or declared emergencies and the like. And it's a engaging topic, and we have had a couple of sessions with him already. I'm really looking forward to next week. We're going to dive into that again, and he will be with us on the first Thursday of the month for the foreseeable future to continue exploring that topic.
Right, because we just have so many topics to cover. This is expanding daily, and it's in the news daily. We have so much current events going on, and people in the different states have different issues. Also, I know you've recently written another paper besides this one, and we'll probably get to that one at some point. I'm still waiting for Manfred Mueller to call into the show today, and when he does, we'll move over to that. But I hope he's getting the message that he is supposed to call in. So we can just keep talking while people are waiting.
Well,
we can keep talking while we're waiting for him. Is there anything else in current events lately that we might want to touch upon?
I continue, I keep naively thinking things will probably settle down, once in a while, and I just keep seeing a flood of information on all different kinds of vaccine-related topics. But I tell you what, the next point in the outline here is a simple one that we can get in and out of quickly, should Manfred come on the line any moment.
Yeah.
And by the way, folks, stick around for Manfred. You'll want to hear this. Manfred is incredibly well-informed and has many, many, many years as a homeopathic physician. He's about as good a source as I could think of to talk about homeopathy and vaccines. So I am, by the way, Debbie, later today with the manager of the Pandemic Response Project, going to speak with the North Carolina Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking this afternoon and asking for their support for enactment of exemptions in the emergency health law so that citizens would have a right to opt out of emergency vaccines. Here in North Carolina. This is something that needs to be taken up, state by state, because it's really primarily and most fundamentally a state law issue. So we're moving forward on that project here in North Carolina.
Right.
We are, I'll say, cautiously optimistic. We're certainly not naive as to the political underpinnings there.
I think I hear Manfred. Manfred, are you with us?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Hey, how about if I close out the show with Alan?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about, it would be a long song. I'll close it out at the end.
Okay.
Alan is a fantastic musician, composer, singer, writer. He's a man of all trades here, and you're going to hear his song at the end of the show, which is just fabulous. We have about 15 folks right now in the live chat, Manfred, and I wanted to give you a lovely introduction. So,
well, Debbie, let me bow out gracefully, and because
yes.
I have to get on to some other things here. Manfred, hope you're doing well. It's great to hear your voice again. I look forward to listening to some of your show this afternoon. And stay tuned,
likewise,
folks. Thank you, Manfred. You guys got some great stuff coming up, so stick around.
Yeah.
Take care.
Well, bye-bye, Alan. Thank you so much. We have on the line Manfred Mueller, a homeopath. He is the distinguished homeopathic practitioner and educator. I know I've taken many courses with him and continue to take clinics. I'm looking forward to those that are upcoming in March. He is also an integrative medicine consultant for the Program on Integrative Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, the Memorial Hospital in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Mr. Mueller has developed a comprehensive approach to homeopathic treatment for the adverse effects of past infections, vaccinations, drugs, toxins, and occupational exposures, which is called reverse chronological tautopathy. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Tautopathy,
so RCT. And in your practice, Manfred, you are using multiple strategies that integrate current scientific insight into homeopathic methodology without sacrificing the classical principles of homeopathy. And Manfred demonstrates daily, with consistently excellent clinical results, that homeopathy is a viable treatment for people with complex chronic disorders, including cancer, as well as for those with the most common complaints. He has published articles in the American Homeopath and the American Journal of Homeopathic Medicine, and he's already into his second term as president of the North American Society of Homeopaths, that is NASH. And I'm going to let you say hello to the folks, and we're going to get started with this hour's programming.
Well, hello, everyone, and thank you, Debbie, for the introduction and for inviting me to appear on your show.
Yes, and we also have another show coming up next week about mercury toxicity, so we're going to learn a lot from you. On our show, we have been talking quite a bit about conventional vaccinations, especially with Alan every week Thursday at noon about the legalities of waivers and exemptions, but a lot of people don't even realize that not only do they not know what their rights are, but they don't know why they wouldn't question having a just typical all the vaccinations. So maybe you could answer that question. Why should they even be concerned?
Well, throughout the history of vaccination, there have always been problems. And one of the problems is that potential adverse reactions from the vaccines. And those have been documented throughout history from every single vaccine. In addition to that, we know that there are often harmful ingredients in vaccines. And one of the most serious ingredients that has been looked at, and it's still in many vaccines, especially for adults, like adult flu vaccine and so forth, are preservatives such as mercury-based preservatives such as thimerosal. Those cause direct harm in many individuals. Sometimes the harm takes a long time to show up. And then, of course, there have been significant numbers of deaths and disabilities associated with vaccines, even though we are assured by public health authorities that this is extremely rare. When you actually look at the data, some of those data are quite impressive. So, for example, after the first year of introducing the Gardasil shot, they had more than 1,600 documented adverse events to that vaccine. So many vaccines have considerable risks associated with themselves, and, of course, that is a reason for being concerned. Then throughout the history of vaccination, there have been always questions about their efficacy. So, for example, currently there's a big question about the efficacy of the flu shots. Do they really work? Do they really prevent the flu? And then finally, throughout the history of vaccinations, we've seen reports that people developed the disease for which the vaccination had been designed. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with the polio vaccine, the only polio documented from since the 1970s were associated with the vaccine. So people are getting polio from the polio vaccine. This has also been documented around the turn of the century, between the 19th and 20th century, with a variola vaccine. So Dr. Charles Crichton, in the ninth edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, documented that many of the so-called smallpox epidemics in Britain were actually vaccine-induced epidemics.
Mm-hmm.
So people were getting the smallpox from the shot.
So how do they validate this? I mean, they have this information. They have it documented.
Dr. Crichton was the expert at the time in infectious diseases and prevention of infectious diseases, and he looked at the health department records in Britain, and he documented the records and showed that wherever they had done smallpox vaccines, they were showing increased numbers of people were getting the smallpox.
So why is this information just simply outright dismissed?
Well, first of all, the Encyclopedia Britannica changed hands. It was bought by, I understand, the Rockefeller family, and the information pretty much was edited out. And the editing is a big issue, as Dr. Vera Scheibner has pointed out. And I don't know if you covered her research.
No, we didn't.
That's well worth looking at. She's gone through some 40,000 pages of published medical research, and showed that throughout the research, there's constantly, repeatedly, there's editing going on, and finagling with data, trying to create the impression that vaccinations were effective, when in reality they were actually not very effective, and also to cover up harm and damage from the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So people can actually change the course of history, I suppose. So can you tell us what, you know, your approach is very different. What is homeopathy for those who are new listeners to the program, and what are homeopathic immunizations?
Well, homeopathy is a medical science developed by a German physician in the beginning of the late 18th and beginning of the 19th century. Hahnemann single-handedly developed a medical science on his own, and he was the first physician to systematically examine and document the action of medications according to their action in biological systems. Prior to that, people had theories about medicine. So, for example, the great William Cullen at the time, a contemporary of Hahnemann, had argued that medicine quinine worked because it was bitter. They had various theories about why these medicines were acting. Hahnemann, for the first time, developed a rational, consistent theory as to why medicines act. And although in standard medical textbooks today he is never given credit for this work, Hahnemann is the father of experimental pharmacology, as Dr. Andrew Weil has pointed out in 1988.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about, was Hahnemann in his day, did he use homeopathic immunizations?
Yes, he did. He was actually the first person to use a rational form of immunization, period. Although some 4 years, actually 3 years before the first time Hahnemann used something, Edward Jenner in England announced that he had discovered a prevention or protection against the smallpox. Jenner was still very uncertain as to what he had actually accomplished, and kept changing, and throughout that time, still changed for the next 30 years. He kept changing the method, so he would at one point use the cowpox approach, then he used a horse disease temporarily.
Gaylers or something like that?
Ganders. Yes.
Yeah.
And then he switched back to, in the end he switched back. He tried a variety of different approaches. In the meantime, Hahnemann had established a method of immunization against scarlet fever, and he first implemented it in the German town of Königslutter. In 1799, he immunized a number of, well, he actually treated a number of children for the so-called Sydenham smooth scarlatina epidemic, successfully cured them with a remedy, belladonna.
Right, I was going to ask you.
And
yeah.
Then he tried to prevent the epidemic in family members, siblings mostly of the children who had been already infected and already had the disease. And
okay.
He gave belladonna preventively to over 100 children, and he found that not one of the children so immunized got the disease.
Maybe people would like to know a little bit about belladonna.
Well, belladonna is a very common homeopathic remedy. It's actually available over the counter in most health food stores, and he gave it in a much more greater concentration than it is used today. Today, it's diluted beyond Avogadro's number. That means it's extremely, and given in an extreme dilution, it's completely safe. The method that Hahnemann used at the time for prevention was he gave it in diluted form, but it was very mildly diluted, very mildly diluted only.
Mm-hmm. So probably if those folks who are listening today ever want to come on the show on Monday, we do study Hahnemann's Organon, and we talk about the potency and whether we've given too crude of a dose or too high of a potency and what to expect in terms of a reaction and response from the living organism. And so he probably found that it did cure or prevent, but there might have been some intensity occurring in their response. So perhaps if they were having a fever or a rash, it might have broken out quite a bit more before the disease would be totally annihilated. We have some things on the chat here. We've got, Dr. Bob is asking about homeoprophylaxis and if you can prevent malaria by using cinchona or prevent flu by using influenzinum. And perhaps you're going to get to that. I don't know. We can answer his question, or we'll put it off until we're up to that section of the talk.
Okay. I'd be glad to do either way.
Go ahead and answer his question.
Okay. Yes, homeopaths have prevented malaria by giving low potency, X potency forms of cinchona. Actually, chininum sulfuratum was used, not cinchona officinalis.
And repeat that. That's cinchona what?
Well, it's actually called chininum.
Okay.
Sulfuratum. It's a form
sulfuratum.
Form of quinine sulfate, and it was given in very low doses, like low X potencies, such as between the 1 and the 3 X potency.
Mm-hmm.
So this prevention is very similar in a way to the allopathic prevention of malaria today.
Really? Because we consider a low potency X quite low, but the word homeopathy, I always tell people, is really a verb. It's the dynamic. It's the similimum or the relationship between the disease symptoms and the medicine's actions, rather
That's
than
correct.
just the name of a drug on a shelf. You know,
correct.
you can pick up this cinchona or aconite or belladonna off the shelf, but I don't call it homeopathic until it's actually acted homeopathically. So I just want to put that in for folks who are listening and don't really understand that homeopathy is a scientific art, and it's a methodology, and it has fundamental laws and principles of nature that make it a science. It is a true science. So just to let people know about that. So he asked about both cinchona, and he asked about influenzinum for the flu, which they do make a new strain every year, as opposed to the acylococcinum, which is from duck liver. So maybe in a future show we could talk more in depth about that.
Yes. I just to comment on the question, the answer to that is yes. Historically, homeopaths have used influenzinum to prevent the flu, and successfully so. There's examples where nosode, and homeopaths call this a nosode if the medicine, the remedies, is made from a viral product, in this case from the flu virus.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Iziaga from Argentina tells of his use of the influenzinum in 1976, where he was immunizing all the nuns in a monastery, and they were living under austere condition without heat in their rooms. He gave each one of them a dose of influenzinum before the winter time. Everyone but the mother prioress took the dose, and she refused to take the nosode. She was relying on prayer.
And, oh, boy.
The only nun that got the flu that year was the abbess. She is the one who was not immunized, got the flu. So homeopathic immunization appears to be correct. There's also been studies about that, and we can talk about that more later.
Okay. So what are some of the diseases that homeopathic doctors have used immunization on, and how effective is it? I think we were already into that question.
Well, I know it's when you look into the diseases that homeopaths have nosodes for, and they're commercially available in virtually every country of the world, except people don't know about them. That includes anthrax is one of the most striking diseases, plague, botulism, cholera. Although cholera, there's been some questions raised as to the efficacy of the homeopathic immunizations, just like there's been questions raised as to the efficacy of the allopathic vaccination.
Can you explain that a little bit more? I mean, you're saying that it works fairly well if you've got a nosode of anthrax or plague or botulism, but for the cholera,
The nosode itself is not very well documented. What has been well documented, however, are specific homeopathic remedies for cholera. And historically, veratrum album and ipecacuanha, as well as some other remedies, were successfully employed. Actually, there is quite a record of that during the 19th century and during real cholera epidemics, where homeopathic remedies were used to prevent cholera. Incidentally, John Clark, a British physician, favored a non-potentized medicine for the prevention of cholera. He would have a copper plate directly touch his skin because he recognized that cuprum, the medicine cuprum, was similar to the epidemic that he was working in, and that copper plate apparently prevented infection. Other physicians used sulfur, literally by adding it to their socks, and they would have sulfur touch their skin, and that then prevented the infection. Then in addition to that, sometimes they would also use so-called potentized homeopathic remedies. Potentization is the process that homeopathic remedies undergo. It's a process of dilution and succussion, where the remedy substance gets diluted out while the information, the electromagnetic information of the substance, is propagated to each between each step of dilution to the next step. And ultimately, that is presumed to be the action of the homeopathic medicine, the electromagnetic stimulus that then triggers the immune reaction in case of immunization.
Right. People probably are not, those who are new to homeopathy are not familiar with the word succussion. And it's sometimes you misread it as succession. It's succussion, and that is a hard tapping of the diluting substance in the water or alcohol where it's pounded. That energizes or creates a vibration within that dilution. And there are tremendous amounts of quantum physics and other kinds of research into that kind of transference of information and what happens at the atomic level. We are not going into that today, but it is a fascinating field and very new and wide open to discussion and learning. So you've covered a number of different diseases that these nosodes.
Well, there are numerous other diseases. Potentially any infectious disease can be treated preventively, or it can be addressed preventively through homeopathy. Like hepatitis has been prevented, Lyme's disease, measles, mumps, rubella, meningitis, both the bacterial as well as the viral form. I already mentioned the plague. Polio, of course, rabies even historically has been prevented successfully even after people were bitten by a proven rabid dog. People were, through the use of homeopathic medicine, the most successful medicine was belladonna, once again.
Yay! We love that belladonna.
In protecting them against the actual outbreak of rabies, the disease.
And what about tetanus?
Tetanus. There's two remedies for tetanus that are most favorably used. They were also tested in experiments on mice, and they found definite protective mechanisms were activated, and the mice so protected were sometimes getting the disease, but a much milder form of the disease. Mm-hmm. And those two medicines are called Hypericum, which is made from St. John's Wort,
mm-hmm.
and Lidum. Or Lidum, some people pronounce
right.
it, and Palustri, and that is marsh tea.
Marsh tea?
Herbal
right.
medicine.
And it's fascinating that these remedies that are being used to prevent disease or after a disease has already started are in the plant family.
Yes, there are other very valuable plants. I've mentioned one of them was Veratrum album.
Right.
Then another one, very, very successful, historically very successful herb that was used. Again, sometimes these medicines were used in unpotentized form simply by using the fresh plant or the tincture of a plant. So, for example, for variola, they use Sarracenia purpurea, which is...
How do you spell that one?
Sarracenia, S-A-R-R-A-C-E-N-I-A, and then purpurea, the purple. It's a pitcher
right.
plant, and
okay.
that was documented to be successful during smallpox epidemics in the 19th century.
Right. So it's sort of like going back to our roots and getting in touch with nature and understanding and observing the actions of the actual plants in nature and what they can do for us, as opposed to pulling out some kind of a particular element or active ingredient and making it into a patented product that you can't get where historically people would be able to heal themselves. So if homeopathic immunization is so effective, why is it not being more widely used?
Well, and as all homeopathy is not widely used, and it's been marginalized to be a fringe medicine actively, directly, beginning almost exactly 100 years ago with the Flexner Report, very powerful people decided they were not going to make available widely this wonderful system of medicine and immunization to the public, but they preferred something that had to be manufactured that they could control and make money off. And so these folks succeeded in marginalizing virtually all other forms of non-drug medicine, including chiropractic and osteopathy and numerous other alternative approaches. Only in recent years, perhaps in the last three decades or so, have we seen a resurgence of homeopathy, especially in the United States, but also in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And in the United States, where homeopathy was almost a mainstream form of medicine in the 19th century, that attack on homeopathy that's still going on to some degree, which is now pretty much sustained by agents of the Pharmaceutical Advertising Council or whatever the current name for the organization is. And,
right. So I have a question. When you want to buy a patented product and the supervising agencies tell us that only specific manufacturers or brands contain a certain quantity of a standardized active ingredient. Is this something that you agree with? It's kind of a little bit off topic, but in terms of, you know, we have plants in our local region that have different components, and when they try and manufacture it and standardize it across the board and have a certain amount of active ingredient in it, is that actually a valid approach?
Well, I think there has to be some standards in herbal, in the use of herbs. People have to know which parts to use. They have to know what to do with those parts. And so herbal pharmacy is a whole science and art by itself. And mm-hmm. Yes, I do support regulation or standards by the profession. And since the public is involved, I think it's also appropriate for there to be public input and even regulation in those standards. But of course,
I know it's not your field.
It's a broad field, and having said that, I also acknowledge the repeated bias from unfortunately from public agencies, including the FDA, in marginalizing, as I said, herbalism, herbal medicine, and homeopathic medicine. So much of this has been shown to be directly related to corporate efforts that have undermined the balance of powers in this respect. So, I'm saying this with extreme caution. I feel like there's been a lot of corruption, unfortunately, that ultimately has hurt those folks who are practitioners and professionals in those fields.
Right. Well,
and also their patients and clients.
You didn't say anything different than what we've been saying for the first hour since noon. We've talked about all of that. Okay, so I'm sure the folks are really very, very interested in the immunization aspect regarding homeopathy. And let's find out, is there any scientific research on homeopathic immunization?
Yes, has been research going on for over 100 years, and that's beyond the clinical research that was done early on, already shortly after Hahnemann performed his first immunization experiments. This clinical research was way ahead of, in fact, the allopathic vaccination research. So, for example, as early as 1833, the German physician Konstantin Hering, who was later emigrated to the United States, had performed experiments with anthrax and with other so-called nosodes, including the rabies nosode that they tested and found to be effective. So these homeopaths were ahead of the game by some 50 years in terms of their experimentation. It was 50 years later when Louis Pasteur made his experiments with the rabies. But even beyond that, studies were conducted. So one early study was referred to in a Iowa case in the Iowa Supreme Court. This was a study on the smallpox immunization. And during that study, homeopathic immunization was compared with the conventional smallpox vaccine and found to be more effective in its prevention of smallpox.
Where did that take place?
This was part of a 1907 decision of the Iowa State Supreme Court. The Iowa State Supreme Court quoted the study and held that upheld homeopathic immunization when I believe the health department there demanded that people were vaccinated with the conventional smallpox vaccine. The Supreme Court upheld the right and quoted the study, which had found that the homeopathic immunization was actually more effective.
Wow. So they were ahead of their time, that
yes.
court. That court was taking an unbiased view and was taking in all of the information to make their final decision. And we need for more of the states to do that and the federal government also. We have some questions here coming in on the live chat. Mary is asking Manfred to a little bit about Kate Birch. And I'm going to tell Mary, we're going to have Kate Birch coming on the show in a couple of weeks. I've already been in contact with her. She is the author of Vaccine-Free Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy. She is going to be a fabulous speaker. Liz has said that medicine has been in fear and acting out of greed. We have to focus on positive change in each and every one of us. Dr. Bob wants to know from you, Manfred, does a person treat? Do you treat a person who is already vaccinated who has had adverse reactions? Well, that's a major part of what Manfred does. I'm sure he's going to talk about it.
Well, yes. Although I think we probably should do a whole special show for this one because there's so much to talk about that we couldn't possibly cover it even in an hour. But yes, we do, and there are specific problems associated with vaccines. Some of them are vaccine specific. Some of them are generic. They are across the board. I will want to give you a quick anecdote of one example.
Sure.
A client had experienced a paralysis in his left arm. It's about in his mid-60s, maybe 65, and mentioned this in, sort of by the way and believed he had been bitten by a spider. Well, when I got a few more details, it turned out that after being bitten by a spider, he had no real symptoms, but he just, being the kind of hypochondriac that he was, went to the doctor and asked the doctor if there's anything he needs to do. So since it had been several days since the spider, the doctor didn't really feel like there was any need to do anything, except he kind of felt like, well, we can give you a tetanus shot. And he gave him a tetanus shot. And within 3 weeks or so, his arm felt weak, and it went on for several months, and after about 6 months or so, he could no longer. By that time, I spoke with him. He could no longer do anything, with his arm was just kind of hanging down. And he mentioned that to me, it's kind of in passing. Oh, there's probably nothing you can do about this. And I I got the story, and I immediately remembered from my studies, my readings about the tetanus vaccine, that brachial palsy or paralysis of the arm is one of the known side effects of that vaccine shot. So I informed him of that, and he took a homeopathic nosode made from the tetanus shot. Actually, you could say it's a pharmacode. We call it a pharmacode. That means it's not made from the disease, but it's made from the drug, from the vaccine. And sure enough, within 3 weeks or so, he recovered the use of his arm simply by antidoting the effects of the tetanus shot with that homeopathic version of it. This is a routine. It's the proper way. It's a routine practice to use the potentized version of a substance that induced the disease. It is capable often of counteracting and undoing that disorder.
Wonderful, wonderful information for those who are new to this type of approach to healing and to undoing side effects from drugs, from vaccines, and just medicines in general.
And the public is not being told about this. Even serious reactions and life-threatening reaction could quickly be counteracted with a homeopathic form of the that very same causative agent. It's really unfortunate how people are being, you know, how the information is being withheld actively. Physicians are not trained in using these. So even you know, conventional drugs, not just vaccines, adverse reactions to conventional drugs could quickly be resolved.
Absolutely. If anybody is on Facebook, we regularly talk about this type topic and have questions and answers regarding people who have been overdosed with drugs and have a drug effect, and what do you do, and what remedies there are available for that. So that kind of answers the question, what can we do about these adverse effects from conventional vaccines? And you have a specific method that you use, don't you?
Yes, you mentioned the reverse chronological tautopathy. It's a systematic method of when someone wants to clear the long-term effects. Many doctors assume that when someone has adverse reactions to drugs, that those adverse reactions go away once you discontinue the drug. That's not so. In many cases, they will have induced a change that produces a latent chronic disorder from which very manifest chronic disorders can result in the future. And so when, let's say, a woman gets a hormone replacement therapy, and then she discovers, let's say, that there may be high blood pressure, stroke, and heart attack associated with that therapy, and decides to discontinue this therapy, and then she gets, let's say, a heart attack or a stroke 10 years later, that could still be a long-term effect from that treatment. These long-term effects have never been documented. The pharmaceutical industry completely ignores them. The FDA completely ignores long-term effects of drugs. Rarely are there studies being conducted on long-term effects of drugs after they were discontinued. But there's no question, there's no doubt that those effects continue. And again, it is worthwhile to counteract or attempt to counteract those latent effects and sometimes apparent effects, and they will disappear under the appropriate treatment.
Right, and I'm sure that Hahnemann in the Organon of Medicine has discussed these particular side effects from crude drugs and the kinds of things that living organisms are have in their system, and
yeah,
the Hahnemann, fact that it does change their vital force.
Yes, Hahnemann, he differentiated between natural and iatrogenic diseases. In Aphorism 74, The Organon, he refers to the chronic diseases derived from iatrogenic causes. In other words, drugs that produce harm in the body and how they change the health of the organism. He discusses that at length. He's very pessimistic about being able to cure those diseases.
Well,
but I think we have a good method in the reverse chronological tautopathy method, and I think that is a very, very practical and useful method that does not require extensive study. It simply can be applied to virtually any patient who has a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that Hahnemann would probably enjoy listening to your talk and working in tandem with you. So how do we, for example, immunize against the specific diseases like what you were just talking about, tetanus, hepatitis, or the plague?
Well, there are several different methods, and that depend on whether you are immunizing prior to a disease or whether you're immunizing during an epidemic. If there's already an established epidemic, homeopaths can determine what they call the genus epidemicus, that is a specific medicine that, by its similarity to the symptoms of the epidemic, is the preferred immunization. So let's say during the scarlatina epidemic that took place at that time in 1801 when Hahnemann immunized these children, belladonna was the preferred medicine. It worked with all of the children. And this has been observed throughout the 19th century. Even thousands of homeopaths used that method. So one method is the genus epidemicus method. There's also the genus morbi method, which is simply the specific remedy for a disease, like I mentioned, Sarracenia purpurea for variola, for the smallpox. There are specific herbs and sometimes also other substances that correspond to specific diseases and are likely to prevent that any given epidemic of that disease. And then finally, there's the nosode, which is the product made directly from the disease itself, from the virus or bacteria, like we have a meningococcinum nosode, which is made from the meningococcus bacteria. And by the way, this was tested in a very large study in Brazil by Dr. David Castro in the 1960s, and he found it was very effective.
Okay. So when you do your process, do you use all of these methodologies? Do you use if there's one in place, then you could use genus epidemicus. If you're using a specific one for the disease, let's say somebody's going out of the country and is required to take an immunization, would you give them the genus morbi?
Well, most countries don't require vaccinations. They recommend, the World Health Organization recommends vaccination for certain countries. I believe there's some African countries where they require yellow fever vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
okay.
Legal issue. I've worked with multiple clients who had questions about the vaccines or were afraid to take the vaccines, in fact, weren't going to take them. and they were inquiring about homeopathic immunizations.
And is that going to work for them?
It has worked for numerous people. I've not seen any cases with homeopathic immunization that I personally know of that they were in many cases. They were endemic areas, like practitioners who went down to Haiti during the cholera epidemic. They were protecting themselves with homeopathic immunizations. Mm-hmm. I had clients go into South America. One of my clients went to South America doing I believe there was a malaria problem, and mm-hmm. With the Audubon Society, and every one of the people, maybe some 30 people, went down there to get photographs of rare birds in the forest in Ecuador, rainforest, and they everyone who went with the conventional vaccination became sick. So the conventional vaccination did not protect them, and they had taken drugs to protect against malaria. There were multiple digestive diseases going around at the time, but they were all ended up in the hospital except for this gentleman who had taken the homeopathic immunization. So it worked for him. I've known of people who went to Africa who did bypass somehow the yellow fever vaccination, and went without it, and just took the homeopathic immunization. Then I know of people who went to India, multiple people, probably more than 100, that all protected themselves just with homeopathic immunization in endemic areas, like typhoid,
right.
And they were faring very well.
So
one of them
got
the typhoid.
They take this preparation. Perhaps the herbals that you would recommend, or other preventative methods, even taking vitamins to support their immune system. And they would do that before they would go on their trip, during,
yes.
Or when would they take it?
Well, they took a protocol of homeopathic immunization that were preventive. They're taken beforehand. They're repeated several times. Studies show that repetition does produce immune response. And so, for example, the protocol that I developed is based on studies. And that's the protocol that has been used by many people. They would take 3 doses a day for 3 days of a nosode or a genus morbi. That means a specific, like in case of hepatitis, it's phosphorus, the remedy phosphorus. And that covers both hepatitis A and hepatitis B because it's most similar to the actual disease.
Mm-hmm.
And these are then taken 4 times, like once a month, let's say. You take 3 doses a day for 3 days in a split dose, in a plus dose in water. And then again, a month later, you do the same thing, a month later again, and so on. And
so for 4 months.
For 4 months. That's
right.
That's, I believe, an effective protection.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty much also based on results from studies.
Sounds very, very interesting, and I'm sure people want to know more about it. Because everybody, I mean, kids who are going for out-of-the-country semesters and things like study abroad, and people who are on vacations or trips or wilderness ventures, adventure
camps. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's so many reasons why people are traveling and they want to protect themselves. And,
that was reason.
Not,
I, go ahead. Well, I
was going to say, and just getting on the plane with everyone.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I recently was reminded of the danger from conventional vaccines. When you do that, a client of mine had a client of her own who, in her business, who was all excited to go to Mexico for a vacation, and took the World Health Organization recommended hepatitis A vaccine, went to the doctor, got the vaccine shot, and had a heart attack right after the shot.
Oh,
and
God.
Heart attacks have been documented to be effects of vaccines. Of course, they deny that because they say there's only a temporal relation. But there is even even a direct relationship between a vaccine shot and a heart attack sometimes. So that can be documented. But the fact is, in this case, this gentleman died. Unfortunately, he never got to go on his vacation. This never happens in homeopathic immunization. Homeopathic immunization is completely safe.
So we know very often, even in our own experience, that let's say you do take the flu shot annually, you typically then come down with flu symptoms. And you can feel so bad that the next year you'll say you'll never do that again. I've heard that story many, many times. Manfred, we have about 9 minutes left. So you still have a lot of time to cover whatever topic you want. We already covered a little bit about your standard protocol. Do you want to go more in depth about that?
No, I don't think that is. I think that, as I said, it depends on whether you want to before the fact prophylaxis, or whether you want to wait until you get into an endemic area, and I think. There are some questions as to how effective any kind of prophylaxis is that's done months beforehand, and also how long they last. And, of course, the same question exists with conventional vaccines. And you would be surprised, and you would need to study Dr. Vera Scheibner's research, both her books as well as her videotaped lectures that she's given, where she goes into detail of the actual research that exists on vaccination, how poor actually the efficacy of conventional vaccines is. And everybody assumes, of course, and I'm sure you've heard this from various newspaper articles claiming efficacy, that it is very highly effective. But in reality, there is no studies that show that a vaccination can prevent any disease. In fact, in every epidemic of any disease, even vaccinated get the disease. The vaccinated get the disease. And sometimes, as you have mentioned, people get perfectly healthy. You get the disease directly from the vaccine.
Exactly. And in Hahnemann's Organon of Medicine, he talks about this. He talks about the changes that occur in the body when you take any kind of medicine or drug, and he gives every scenario possible about the changes that you are likely to see depending on what you're given and how it is given, whether it is homeopathically or medicinally. And it sounds as if you use quite a bit of herbs in your toolkit, in your medicinal toolkit also. And I think that we can consider those to be homeopathic if they're based on similar symptoms.
Correct. When you use a homeopathic medicine based on the symptoms, like in the case of even a genus morbi is based on the symptoms, that means you select a substance, in some cases an herbal medicine, that corresponds to the disease. And if it's been shown effective again and again and again, then it is homeopathic to that disease. That means similar in symptoms.
Right. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. We've learned quite a bit from you. I would like to give you an opportunity to tell us about what you have coming up in the clinic and for resources for people to learn more about you.
Well, we have website under construction, which is about our courses, thehomeopathiccollege.org. I'm sorry, thehomeopathiccollege.org.
Okay.
And you can also contact us directly and get on our mailing list. We've got a mailing list all over the world that goes out, a newsletter that goes out and announces our teaching clinics, and as well as the tutorials I do. Most of those are telephone conference type tutorials at this point.
Okay, and you've got some toxicity seminars coming up, and we're going to speak with you again on Monday specifically about mercury toxicity. I'm looking forward to that because it's prevalent in our society today with amalgams that have now been quite controversial, and more dentists are changing over to composites. And
right.
I'm sure you have a lot of information about that and ways of clearing the body from all of these toxins.
Yes,
so,
and of course, as I mentioned, the vaccines, too, have give you thimerosal, also causes mercury toxicity, and so do other sources of mercury.
So let me just check in the chat room. We've got still some guests. Do you have any last comments or questions for Manfred before we're going to close the show? I'm going to let you sign off listening to Alan Phillips singing a most beautiful song in his voice and everything. If not, I appreciate everybody saying goodbye. We have Mary has mentioned something about Kaniska. Gets these from India, Bengal Allen. This is where she orders her remedies. So what is she saying? Oh, she's giving us a place, naturalliving.com, who can order nosodes. So she's got a reference there. And
very
Mary
good.
Has also talked about, Barbara Trollby is asked, is it possible that OCD to return as a result of vaccinations? So maybe we can take that up. Well, I don't know if you have a one-line answer for that. We've got about 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, I found OCD is definitely related to mercury, so OCD can be associated with vaccination. And OCD sometimes comes or develops 20, 30 years after the vaccine is injected. So, yes, obviously OCD can develop long after a vaccination.
Right.
And I'm
really concerned about Alzheimer's because I think that there is a huge connection between that loss of memory and inability to communicate and things like that. So we're going to say thank you so much, Manfred.
You're
going to
thank you.
Sign off here. And I thank everyone who has come to listen to us today. And please tell your friends. Don't forget that you can favorite our show. You can be a follower, a fan. You can tweet, a retweet, and put it on Facebook. You can even put the widget for this radio show on your own website, which would be fabulous to get the word out. Thanks so much, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be unfurled. Girl, one by one we are free.